So like I said, I was on the recovery mission of Michael Murphy, and I transitioned really quickly. Like I said, I was supposed to be in my internship starting July 1st. You know, I called them on the 28th. And I'm like, I'm not going to make it. You know? And so I showed up, and then like, I think on the 12th, I was back in the States, and I had my white coat, and I'm like, what the hell just happened to me? but a good way to kind of delve in and kind of bury yourself is a medical internship where you're just grinding it out again. But I just remember having this feeling, this sad feeling of loss, you know, like all those guys died for what, you know, and it always stuck with me. And then I started CrossFit in 2007 when I was doing my residency. And, you know, I don't know how familiar you guys are with CrossFit, but the Hero Wads, you know, back in 2007, there was like four of them, and one of them was Murph. And I was like, hey, I wonder if that's the same Murph that I recovered. And so I researched it, and sure enough, you know, and I was like, well, I'm going to do Murph on Memorial Day. Because usually Memorial Day for me, you know, just I ended up sad and drunk and feeling sorry for myself. So I'm like, this will be a good way to just kind of get out there, bust it out, suffer, do a little bit of reflection. And I did it. And I was like, that was awesome. And so the next year I told the gym, I'm like, hey, we're all going to do this on Memorial Day. And right, we had that same experience that you had. I'm like, this is fantastic. I'm like, this needs to be a national pastime. This needs to be a tradition that we do in the United States.
Taking some time to come join us. We really, really appreciate it. We know you're a busy man. So we've been showing on our social medias just all the athletes and the coaches we've been working with. And a mutual friend, Lindsay Barra, reached out to me. And she goes, you have to meet Josh. And then so we started the talk. So first of all, Lindsay Barra, she is Yogi Berra's granddaughter.
I feel like I recognize that.
Yeah, Yogi Berra's granddaughter, and she produced this documentary on Yogi Berra.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's really good.
It's so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they don't make guys like that anymore. That's no offense to anybody in this room, but yeah. Seriously, that guy, I mean, they just don't make that kind of man anymore. I don't know if it's situational or what, but that guy was just amazing.
We were saying stories that we've never heard of before.
I had no idea. Yeah. I just saw him as the guy that was the funny guy, that was the guy that almost like a clubhouse glue guy, but he was a 10-time World Series champion, MVPs, and top five of MVPs for multiple years in a row, almost every single year. All stars, but all you hear is the yogiism.
Yeah, right.
Yep. I was
he's
so
shadowed
good
by that for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so we started learning a little bit more about you and the incredible missions you've done, and we're going to get into these amazing stories. Yeah. But where I want to start is your stint in the German circus.
Oh, yeah, right. Right. So it's nice to be back among my fellow professional athletes.
Yeah.
Amen, brother.
Little known secret. In the early 90s, I was a professional high diver in a German amusement park. I was a Division I springboard platform diver for Arizona State University, and I was approached my last year of eligibility to see if I wanted to do this thing in an amusement park. Initially as a clown diver, which I think reflects on my skills as a diver, that they would cast me in that role. But they had the show in Germany, and I have family in Germany, and so I went over and I did a stint as a German high diver in an amusement park.
That's amazing.
So,
into the
bucket. If you close your eyes and you picture a high diver, So, it was pretty amazing. I got to perform in front of, you know, tens of people. So it's pretty amazing.
That's awesome. So, that is so cool. And so
it was a lot of fun.
And so from there, can you tell us a little bit about your story and just, and then we do want to get into to some of your favorites, some of your missions. And we have some questions, additional questions, but we want to hear the journey of your path.
Yeah. And it's funny that we start with that story, because really that story, was kind of the first time where I faced a goal that I initially thought was impossible, right? I got there and I was just supposed to be this, clown diver, and I walk in and I see this 90-foot ladder going up into the air, with this little perch on it in front of this, 15-foot, pool. And I was like, there is no way I could ever do that. And I it wasn't even something I would consider. Because you look at it and it's just ridiculous. And you're like, how do you even do that? And so as a typical guy, I'm like, hey, well, maybe. And so what we did was we could take the perch and we could move it. And so I started, I was a platform diver, which is 30 feet or 10 meters, 33 feet. Right. And so I would start there. And then, I went a little bit higher and a little bit higher. And I think I was like at 60 feet or something. And the boss was like, hey, why don't you do the high dive in the show? That way, you get up there and you'll have the audience and you'll have the adrenaline and then you'll have to do it. I was like, that sounds like a great idea, right? So I start to climb, there's a dramatic music and I get to the top of this thing. And the top, it's literally just a ladder on wires, so you're just right out in the middle of it, 90 feet in the air. And the top of it is just kind of screwed on, so it kind of wiggles a little bit. And I got up there, and this thing's shaking, and I'm shaking, and I'm like, what the hell have I got myself into?
Start to rethink this a little bit.
And I turn around, and I'm like the old cartoons where you're like, and I'm up there and I'm contemplating, all right, how do I get out of it? Like, what would happen if I literally just climbed down? And she said, no, I'm not going to do this. But I took a deep breath and I said, I've been practicing, it's the same thing. It's just a little bit higher. I took some deep breaths, kind of got myself into place, and I jumped and I did the dive. And then I did it for, the rest of the summer. But then I look back on that. And I think, if I can do that, I can do anything. And then it was, metaphorical. Like, I would just take it, one rung at a time. And so I often think about that when there's a big goal. I'm like, just one rung at a time, just keep moving that perch. And that's really what inspired me to go to medical school. Because I never thought, I'm really not that smart. And you have to be smart to go to medical school. And you really don't. You just have to be able to grind it out and dedicate yourself. And I thought, here's the rungs. Here's this. And then, that 90-foot high dive is graduating medical school. Yeah,
that is incredible to hear. Is it similar to being a professional baseball player? Any that principle of one rung at a time, a little bit better, a little bit better? Have you
the process thing that we keep talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what makes baseball so different than other sports. Is when you break spring training in February, early March, it is small goals all the way up until October, and it's so hard to really just stay focused on that and not steer away from those goals. And it's like we talk about with Sue all the time, you want to stack the small wins.
Right.
And that is what's so unique about baseball is that mental side of the game. You just got to keep stacking small wins, and all the best players do, and never kind of steer the direction either way.
Yeah. I love what you said too. It's like you got to the top and things are shaking. And then you just remember to trust your training. Hey, trust the training and go, which leads me to the thing that was really fascinating. One of my favorite movies is Lone Survivor.
Oh, yeah.
And for those who have not seen, I don't know if you guys have seen it, Marcus Luttrell.
Yeah,
unbelievable,
yeah.
Unbelievable story. And when I heard about your involvement in this story, it blew my mind. And I would love to hear, just for those who don't know, the background of what it is, who haven't seen the movie, and then what role you played in that.
All right, so it's really an interesting story. From my perspective, because I really probably shouldn't even have been there. don't know how much time we got, but I'll take us back to it. So there I was, born. So I was a pararescue specialist. For those that don't know, pararescue is combat search and rescue arm of the United States Air Force. And their specialty is combat search and rescue medics, but really trained to go into any sort of situation. You know, whether that be air, land, or sea, you know, scuba diving, mountain climbing, all of this stuff, but also highly skilled medical personnel. I went to Arizona State with the hopes of becoming a doctor. And after, I don't know how many of you guys know about Arizona State, but it's a fun school.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
There's a lot of distractions.
I signed my national letter of intent to go there. Didn't go, but...
Yeah.
Big party school is what I heard.
Yeah, so right.
Yeah.
As a young man, there were plenty of distractions there. Needless to say, I didn't get into medical school and was kind of lost. And I'm like, well, I don't really know what to do. And I just kind of stumbled across this thing called Pararescue. And, you know, their motto is that others may live. And I'm like, and that's really cool. The history of it is back in Vietnam. It started way back in World War II, but really kind of cut its teeth in Vietnam, where the PJs, their pararescue specialists or pararescue jumpers, PJs for short, would go down on these on the hoist and the helicopters through the triple canopy of the Vietnam jungle and rescue downed air crew, and just some amazing stories that come out of Vietnam, and really a not well-known special operations job that, you know, everybody knows about Navy SEALs and, you know, Force Recon, the Green Berets. And so it's a very small group of people. And it really appealed to me. And so the phrase that has gotten me in more trouble than anything is, how hard could it be, right? Like, oh, I'm a fit guy, you know? I had no idea what I was getting into. And this was before the days of the internet. So I had this like threefold brochure that I, you know, I'm like, they got pictures of guys jumping out of airplanes and, you know, hanging from a helicopter. And I'm like, that looks pretty cool. And I got there and was slapped into reality quickly. It's a 12-week selection school. So you've probably seen like the BUDS, you know, where the selection for, and it's about, you know, 85% attrition rate. So, you know, 15 of 100 make it. And I think there was almost 60, 65 people in my group, and we graduated 7. And so really just whittling down, you know, and it was really a lot of water confidence and just being uncomfortable and making, you know, just making you uncomfortable and putting you in these situations where you're underwater, you can't breathe, you have a task that you need to complete. And a lot of people just don't do well in that situation, right? It wasn't the calisthenics, it wasn't the running, it was the water confidence that really got you.
Panic, it just makes you panic.
Right,
you're
panic.
Underwater,
yeah. Right. So I made it through that, right? And it was just one rung at a time. And I often pictured myself, you know, just climbing that ladder. And, you know, sometimes people say, oh, you know, just one day at a time. This is like one event at a time. I'm like, just let me make it through that pool event, or just let me make it through this. And then just keep your head down. And by the end, you know, you just grind it out. And so the training for pararescue is about 2 years, and it was just awesome. You know, it's like a, I would imagine what a minor league team is. You know, you're going out and you're doing things, you're learning a skill set, and you're just creating these bonds, these friendships.
In a team
yeah,
environment?
Yeah. And so you're just learning, you're getting all these experiences. And then I graduated and we get a maroon beret, and, you know, feel like you look pretty cool in a maroon beret. and so then I started doing the job and I loved it. It was a great job. This was early or mid to late 90s. We were, you know, over in Saudi Arabia. This was before kind of any of the big things had kicked off. And it was just a great job and, you know, great camaraderie. And we were supporting the space shuttle launches. And after 5 years, I realized, I'm like, I still really want to be a doctor. And so I separated from active duty. I moved to Tucson, where they have a reserve team and they have a medical school. And I kind of just reapplied myself and then ultimately got into medical school. Well, I started medical school in August of 2001. And then I kind of came to a crossroads. There was a, I came to a fork in the road, so I took it. And so my enlistment was ending, and I was new medical school. So I thought, do I separate from pararescue and just kind of go down this path of medicine? You know, it'd be a nice transition, but you know, I still really liked it. And I had a skill set that was still useful. And so, I re-enlisted, September 9th, 2001. Mm. Right. I'm like, and 2 days later, right, September 11th happened and everything changed. And I was like, all right, I'm out. I'm getting out of medical school. You know, our country is at war and it's time to use those skills that, you know, that I've learned over the last 6 years, 7 years. So our team, I was a reservist. So our team was activated, which means we were called to active duty. And my teammates, you know, we had a team meeting and my teammates, and I'll never forget this, you know, they said, Josh, you know, we know how hard you work to get into medical school. We want you to stay in medical school. Cause I was like, screw this, right? I'm going.
How long were you along? How much longer did you have left to graduate from medical school?
It was, that was my first year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. So it's 4 years. And they said, we want you to stay back. Train up the folks to come over, right? We went, we were deployed to Turkey, right? There's nothing really going on. And so I never forgot that, right? That was a sacrifice for them, because that meant time away from their family. And that always stuck with me. And so I stayed back and I trained the guys and I went over, you know, I did what I could, but really that was my focus, was medical school. In 2005, I was graduating from medical school and we got activated again. And I said, there's no way I'm going to let these guys carry my weight again. And I said, I'm graduating May 11th. I'm like, May 12th, I am ready to go. Because we were reactivated. And this time we were being sent to Afghanistan in 2005, right? I mean, that's kind of when, you know, it was really rocking and rolling over there. My poor parents, you know, they're like, finally, you know, your boots are on the ground. Like, you're settled. Yeah. You know, you're graduating medical school and, you know, you're going to be safe. And I was like, oh, Mom, Dad, you know, I volunteered to go to Afghanistan, right? And so it was rough on them. And
did they try to convince you, obviously, not to go?
They didn't, right. I mean, they...
Support, too.
Yeah, right. They're like, we don't agree with it. We don't like it. But, you know, of course, we support you. And so I graduated medical school. And then, like, a couple of days later, I was on a military transport to Afghanistan. And so I was technically a doctor, but I was in the role of pararescue. And so that was my main job. When I got over there, I told, you know, the hospital, I'm like, hey, I'm a doctor. Do you guys need me to do anything? And they let me dive in and do all kinds of really cool things. I hate to say cool things because it's a horrible situation, but things that, you know, as a doctor, you don't get that kind of training unless you're in a wartime environment. So we just kind of went through and we were doing our thing. And I was supposed to start my internship on the 1st of July. And on June 28th, I was literally loading all of my gear into the containers where we load onto the plane. And, you know, I'm kind of daydreaming about my new job. Like, I'm going to be a doctor. You know, I'm picturing like scrubs and ER, you know, mm-hmm. When we get this call on the radio, you know, like all rescue personnel report to the command center, and I walk in and you can tell like something bad has happened, right? You can just feel, like, I walked in and it was palpable. You just feel what's, you know, and they said that an Army Chinook helicopter had just been shot down and there were 16 people on board and they didn't know what the status of that of the crew was, and they felt the Taliban was moving in to the crash site and they needed us up there like now. And so I had to, you know, pull all my stuff out, get my head back in the game, and we boarded a plane to Bagram, which was up north. We were down south in Afghanistan. And when we arrived, they said that, you know, they felt the, or they confirmed that all 16 people on board that helicopter were killed. However, they were launched as a quick reaction force to for a distress call made by a still unaccounted for four-man Navy SEAL team. And now it was our job to go out and try and find them. All right. So, I mean, things got serious like right away. And so we searched and we searched. We flew, you know, trying to listen for radios, or signals, anything. And, you know, it was a couple of days and we didn't find anything and didn't hear anything and got no intel. And
just flying blind trying to find these guys.
Right. Well, we knew the area, right? And so we're flying around trying not to get shot out of the air.
Were there attempts? They saw you and they were...
So there was that I know of, like I saw an RPG come at us, and luckily it missed us. And so on the 2nd of July, I don't remember the exact timing, but an Afghani guy, older gentleman, dropped off a note from a base camp, and it was from one of the SEALs. And it said, hey, you know, I'm in this village, I'm injured, Taliban's closing in, I need help. And so this village elder told us where they were. And so that night, and it was from Marcus Luttrell. So that night, we flew in to the Hindu Kush, which is just the elevation is, you know, I forget what the elevation is, but it's challenging flying for the helicopter pilots. And so our plan was just to go in as light as possible, like make the helicopter as light as possible. So we stripped everything off that we didn't need, right? Mm-hmm. Which included a lot of our offensive weapons. Like we have a big minigun in there that it's really heavy and a bunch of bullets. And then we also took out all the Kevlar flooring, which would protect us from bullets because we wanted to just be quick and nimble. And we flew in. And I don't know, in the movie, you know, you kind of land in this big field in the middle of the day. And so this, we flew in at night, you know, under night vision goggles. And we landed like on the side of a cliff. Like this village was up in the mountains and on one side was a mountain and the other side was just this big cliff. And as we came in, we browned out. And so the dirt and the dust in the air kicked up and the pilot couldn't see anything. And we start to drift to the right and the engineer on the right's like, stop right. And I'm just in the back thinking, all right, this is it. And then we start drifting to the left. And I remember looking out the window and not seeing anything, you know, and just feeling the helicopter like going over the edge. And finally, that Spanky, who was our pilot, because he looks like the Little Rascals character, just dumped the helicopter on the ground. And as soon as I knew we were on the ground, I was like, go. And we came out of the helicopter, just ran all the dirt and the dust is in the air. And everything had been turned around. The survivor's supposed to be out at the, you know, at the 2 o'clock position, but that was a mountain and on the other side's a cliff. So we're looking around and we know there's bad guys in the area. And then I see two people approaching the rear of the helicopter. And I'm like, this can't be a Navy SEAL, right? Because, you know, the tail rotor. Mm-hmm. And so we lift our weapons and I'm like, is this the good guy or bad guy? Good guy or bad guy? And I still can't tell. And I notice they're in like Afghani garb. So I flip the, you know, safety off of my weapon, right? And I'm looking through my sights to see if I can make out who it is. And I'm like, I can't let them get to the helicopter, right? Cause it's the guy with a grenade or a weapon or whatever, right? I can't let them get to the helicopter. And it felt like forever. It was probably 10 seconds, you know, but I just kept saying over my head, good guy, bad guy, good guy, bad guy. And finally, over the intercom, my teammate's like, it's our precious cargo. And I was like, right. Wow. So I like sling my weapon. I set on safe and we go get him and we pull him in and we get him out. You know, we fly out of there. But as we had him on the helicopter and as we're taking off, that is like the most dangerous part of a rescue mission. Cause oftentimes, you know, they'll let you land, they'll let you get on board. And then as you're taking off, then they shoot you out of the sky. So everybody's head was on a swivel and we're making sure that, you know, we get out of there. And then finally we get to a Marine base and we all kind of exhale And then as we're taking Marcus off the helicopter, you know, he had some pretty bad injuries. His back was messed up. And he, like, I always say that, you know, I've never seen anybody look more tired than him. I mean, he was just exhausted and beat up. And as we're getting him off the helicopter, we're going to put him on a fixed-wing plane. He looks at me. He's like, hey, I want to walk to the aircraft, and he's about your size, right? And so I'm like, all right, whatever you want to do. Like, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to carry this guy. You know, there's two of us, but, and that would have been awkward. So I was glad he wanted to try and walk. And so then we got him back to base, and that's when he told us that he was the only surviving member of his team, and where his teammates' bodies were. And so in the movie, other than, you know, all the Hollywood stuff, I wish they would have let people know that we went back in on the 4th of July, ironically, to get his teammates as well. So we recovered his bodies as well. And one of those teammates was Michael Murphy, who ended up getting the Medal of Honor for his actions during that. And then, you know, that's where the workout Murph came from. And then,
I want to ask more about the Murph. I want to ask about the Murph. But there was one time I was talking to a coach in the NFL, and we were talking about the military, and he was going to give an example. But he said something really interesting. He goes, a lot of times in sports, coaches and athletes try to make comparisons to the military. And he's like, we got to stop with that. Like, we are nothing. Like, what we're doing is nothing like these stories. Like, our lives are not on the line. We are not saving the country, or we're not doing these things. However, what he said, we like to pull out lessons from them, how to be a team, leadership, culture, how to perform under pressure. As I was listening to this, I started thinking about all of the preparation, stress. We talk about being comfortable being uncomfortable, all of that kind of stuff. What was your guys' like, as you were like listening to this story and pressure and I don't know, curious on what you think.
We tend to put pressure on ourselves, and it comes from everywhere else, thinking that what we do is life or death. Like, it's be all and end all.
Disrespectful to say that right
now. No.
Absolutely, right. It does. But that's what I'm saying. Hearing you talk, it's like, we have nothing to worry about. Our performance on the field is not going to dictate the lives of 15 people, 30 people.
Yeah.
The people that you've affected, the people you've been able to obviously you've done some things that we can't even think about, but you are looked at as heroes, and baseball players are looked at as heroes, where in actual fact, when you break it down, you're the hero in this story. I feel kind of.
When I say I feel embarrassed to compare the two, so as an athlete, as a baseball guy, you have all the training. You prepare yourself for a season.
Yeah.
You take hits, reps in the cage. You're taking batting practice. And then when the game goes, it's a little different feeling. It's like, all right, this is action. Like, now we go. So when you're in these situations and you're wondering whether or not to pull the trigger, that is the true life or death scenario. So how do you take yourself to just relax and you trust the training, you trust your teammates? Like, that's
how you do it.
Not panic in that situation. Is it, you don't know whether or not you're going to be in this situation. Guys you've trained with have never been in this situation. So when it happens, is there just something that you're like, hey, I'm prepared for this. This is what I've done. And you just lock in?
Yes, because it's so similar, right? Like, the circumstances may be different, but the feelings, I imagine, are the same, right? Like, you're up to bat, you know, and there's thousands of people, millions of people watching you, you know, and this is personal, right? Like, I don't want to let anybody down. Like, I don't want to let my teammates down. I want to make sure that I give it my best. And that's why, like training, like, I'm just locked in. Because when you come to these situations, you don't want to let anybody down, and right? I'm sure it's the same way with the teammates.
So there's a difference between not driving in a runner from second and you doing what you're doing.
Right, but the physiologic response is the same, right? You would argue that. So yeah, I think it's a totally fair comparison.
The teammates and the trust, how do you know you have that?
Yeah.
Do you know by the training and these guys are doing stuff good? Do you know by the bond you guys have? Or do you guys know the assignment? Hey, this is what we signed up to do for, and we're going to do this. So is that trust kind of built like that, or?
So there's an inherent trust, right? Because you know, just like when you're in the big leagues, you know that everybody has passed this, everybody has a certain skill set, right? And everybody can perform to a certain level. So there's that baseline, but then there's the difference in like a winning team where all of those people are working together. Like it's not just, you know, 12 individuals, right? Yeah. It's six individuals that have worked together that, you know, in pararescue, you literally have your teammates' lives in your hands, right? If you're checking a parachute or, you know, you're exiting an aircraft together in a parachute jump, right? If you're over the top of them, like, or you set up a rock system where you're hanging off the edge of a mountain, right? Your life is literally in their hands, and it creates a bond that.
And it's so wild too, because we talk about process and decision making, and when some of these calls happen, the plan or the way you guys train has to change on the fly.
That's what I was thinking too.
And you guys are just all bought in, and it's just boom, let's go. And to me, it's just unreal to fathom mentally of, you know, no, we got to do this. My wife and I, we talk about where we're going to dinner, and it seems like it's 30 minutes back and forth.
Yeah.
And boom, boom, boom. You guys.
I have that same conversation. I don't care. I'll go anywhere. All right.
Is that just something like in training? It's like, all right, if it goes like this, we trust and we just keep going. It's all the trust.
It's based on trust, but it's also leadership, right? Like you really got to trust your leadership and to make that right call. And that's just based on experience. And for that mission, I certainly wasn't the best PJ. I wasn't the highest ranking PJ, but they picked me to be, you know, the team leader to pick up Marcus. And a lot of that was based on, you know, my medical training, my skill set, but I think it was based on trust, right? Like maybe I'm promoting myself, whatever. It's not what I'm trying to do, but I feel like, they knew I would do the right thing, that I would make the right call. And, you know, deep inside, I'm terrified. I'm like, they're like, who should be the, the team leader? And somebody's like, Apple. I'm like, oh, I don't think I'm like that guy. Right? But then it's right time to step up. And
something we talk about often is trusting your training in professional sports. And I'm sure very obviously the military as well. But one thing we always talk about are teams are trying to get a competitive advantage by trying to replicate practice to be the real thing.
Yeah.
So, okay, we have technology, we have all these, okay, let's try to make it like the real thing. But in practice, you don't have the adrenaline, you don't have the what is your philosophy or the military's philosophy on training? Because like Haas just said, you can train and then you're put in a situation where you're like, we weren't expecting this at all.
Trained for that. Right.
You can't train for this. You can't get the physiological response. How do you all train?
You can, and you try and throw in those variables, right? Like, here's a training mission, and this is the objective. And then you throw in some variables where you're like, that's not possible anymore. So now what do we do? And so a lot of that is the training, because like you said, you can't train for every situation. So you try and anticipate as every situation that you can, and you train for that. But in the end, it's go time, right? Like you just gotta be ready for it, and you hope that your past experience somewhere back there is something similar.
I don't know how I even ask this question, but something that we talk about often in sport is learning from failure, embracing failure. In your world,
if you fail,
it's a life. It can be.
There's degrees of failure, of course.
What are your thoughts on? We talk about failure a lot. We talk about leadership and failure and success. Right. But what are your thoughts on failure in general?
Yeah, I'm sure it's similar. That those are the lessons you learn from the best, right? I talk so much about failure with my children, right? Because it's like, good, you failed. How's that feel, right? Like, it sucks, doesn't it? How do we prepare ourselves not to feel that? Like, remember this feeling. In the military, there's, there's certain scenarios where failure often, leads to death or severe injury or stuff. And so you do all you can to mitigate that. And and you try and learn, from others. You know, that's one of the things the military does is, you know, they'll deep dive stuff like, why did this crash happen? You know, there's a full investigation and then there's lessons learned, and we try and learn from those lessons, but there's nothing that teaches you better than your own failure, right?
That's so true. Speaking of, I think it was yesterday, a couple of days ago, we were going by all of the pitchers Hosmer has faced in his MLB career. And there's some dudes on that list, like, and he's faced thousands of at-bats. And what's interesting, some top pitchers in the game, future Hall of Famers, Hosmer was very successful facing them. But here's the funny thing. He hit 300 off some of them. He hit high 290s off some of them, high 300s. But when you really step back and look, you failed 70% of the time. We're like, wow, you dominated, and you failed 70% of the time. What's your take as a major league hitter on failure? Because you're well acquainted with that.
It's just like there's no avoiding it, right?
Yeah.
Adversity and life and whatever it is, there's different scales of that. But at the end of the day, there's no avoiding it. So it's what I love what you say about with your kids. It's like, listen, like, how are we going to learn from this? You know, this is failure. This is what it feels like. How do we prepare to not have this same feeling again? And this all just blows my mind, because at the end of the day, it's just a win or a loss for us. It's a strikeout or a hit. And what you guys do is a whole nother level. And, you know, even now, like for me, so, you know, my calling is baseball. That's how I feel like I can reach guys. That's how I can give back. And we talked about Yogi. This guy won 8 World Series as a player, then came back to be a manager, won 2 like that. So your involvement, you stay finding roles because you want to have that involvement. You want to continue to pass down and give down. And I would just imagine that's because that bond, that trust, that those teammates, you just never want to, you want to always feel like you're giving your piece to them. And that's got to be the coolest feeling for you to continue to give back and take these different roles, because you know you're doing the right thing and that's your calling and you're aiming for that group.
Right. And it's really why I stayed in the military after that mission. I mean, that's a once in a lifetime mission. You know, most people don't get a mission like that. And I feel lucky to be even a part of that, because anybody could have done that. Right. It just happened to be me. but I also feel an obligation to those 16 that died on the helicopter, to the other teammates, you know, that I bear some of that responsibility, that I move forward and I make things better and make, you know, kind of lead a path for the new generation. And that's right where you are right now, right? Like you're done with the teams, and now how do you give back? And that's something that I just really enjoy, is mentorship. You know, I think, especially men these days, young men these days, are a little lost, you know. And when people come to me and they're like, hey, I want to be a PJ or I want to be a doctor, I always start off with, look, if I can do it, you can do it, right? Because there's nothing special about being a PJ or about being a doctor. I mean, there's something special about being a professional athlete, right, that takes a certain skill set. But really, the stuff I've done is just grinding it out, right? Like,
yeah, no, I think, were you going
to
say something?
Just the way you downplay what you've done compared to, and then putting us on a pedestal, that's just kind of, it's kind of funny to me. But I guess we all have that similar personality where we don't think what we do is that special compared to the life of somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody can hit a baseball or throw a baseball fast, or, you know, that takes a certain skill set.
So does having the balls to do what you did.
Right, but I feel like anybody in that situation, like, has the ability to do that. It has the ability to just grind it out. Just put your head down and grind it out. But not everybody can hit a fastball.
So you talk about,
I'm gonna argue this.
I don't know if I have the balls.
That's what I'm saying. Throw me in a chopper and say, hey, we're searching for 4 guys.
Right.
Life or death situation. I don't know that I could do that.
Right. But you go back and you do all the training.
Right.
And then we put you in that spot. You're like, yeah, I got this all day. Yeah. Whereas you put a guy who's been swinging a baseball for 10 years and you put him in the major leagues, like, that's not going
to happen. That's after selection. So cool. if you go through the selection and you're one of the 7, so that's...
Because you don't jump right to rescuing Navy SEALs.
There's no training that can prepare you for the adrenaline of having to do that life.
Rung by rung.
So how about mentorship? And you talk about, you know, leading some guys. How... in the military space and what you guys do, how have you adapted with that? Because the young player from when you debuted in the big leagues to the young player now is so different.
Yeah.
Physically more mature, mentally there's a lot more on their plate. So how do you guys adapt in that process of, you know, mentoring some of the younger guys of this generation now?
So I retired from the military in 2020. My first 12 years was as a PJ, and then my second 12 years was as a flight surgeon. And the only reason, I mean, that sounds like a cool job, but you don't really fly and you don't do surgery. was really in that mentor role because I was the team doc for the PJ team. And there's a lot of, right, because pararescue is medicine based, right? It's you, you're paramedics, you're a nationally registered paramedic. And so a lot of the guys kind of want to make that transition into medicine. And I was one of the first that kind of blazed that trail to get into medical school. And so that was one of the things that kept me in the military is that I'm, you know, I'm mentoring these PJs that then want to be physicians. And the training to become a pararescue is called the pipeline. And so I called it the advanced pipeline, you know, right? Which helps you transition out of pararescue into a new career that's rewarding as medicine. But yeah, the things change, right? The training changes and, you know, some of the pressures change, but ultimately it's the same guys, right? I mean, it's the same situation. They all have the same feelings. They all have the same doubt. They all need that same person to kind of just say, look, you got this, right?
And
so.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, kind of like we said to you before, like, I don't know if I have the balls to do something like that. Is there ever cases where guys come in and it's just like, man, like, I can't do this, but you can't quit on them. And you're like, no, we're going to do this. And you guys, you work through it and you eventually get to a spot where they're confident and, you know, they're.
Or they quit or they, right. It's like I said, that first training part that the selection school where you get, you know, 85%, 90% attrition, that selects out a lot of people. But some people get into it and then they're like, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't want to be like, you want to be supportive, but you also don't want to convince somebody into a position like that that doesn't want to be there, right? Like, you got to have your head in the game. Like, if you're not 100% committed to the MLB, you're like, there's other people that will be and that can be. And it not only is a detriment to you, but to the team.
Your whole unit, yeah.
So there's a fine line for sure where you're like, oh, no, you got this. And then you're like, oh, I don't know if you got this.
It's like the fascinating thing between sports world and the military world is like the good teams get the guys to buy in. They get that culture where everyone's doing their job. The bad teams, you know, people are on their own doing that type of thing. And it's not working in sync like that. But like, there's just no other decision for you guys. Like, it's got to be, we need everybody doing their role. And like you said, it affects everybody on their unit. It affects everybody on their team. So it's just, it's mind blowing. It really is all the team and the mentorship stuff we're talking about. Cause when you really do measure and scale it,
yeah,
it's life or death versus a win or loss. So it's, how do you compare? How do you even, you know, talk about that in the same light?
Something as you just said, it reminded me of what Peter, you always talk about just in your life and everything you've accomplished and everything you've overcome. You've been telling us, you just say yes. Mm-hmm. You always right. say yes.
And always
you,
say
and,
yes.
And yeah. And right. So yeah, what, as you're hearing him talk about going for it and shooting, like what?
I think it's just a great overall message that I've found a lot of my buddies and a lot of guys that I talk to, they're afraid to jump into that next thing because of what may come from it or what may happen from it. And I've just learned since I've retired from baseball, especially, and even throughout the course of my baseball career, that if you just give something a chance, if you just give it a go, from the outside, it may look one way. Until you dive in, you really have no understanding of what you're getting into. And you just need to open up your mind a little bit and just start saying yes to a lot more people and a lot more things.
Right. Like doing a podcast. Like this was a situation years ago that I would not have enjoyed. I'm not really good talking to people. I used to not enjoy it. I've kind of grown into it and enjoy it now, but it terrified me.
Another like, important
I'd much rather hang out of a helicopter than sit, you know, in a group and talk to people. Right. But I said yes.
Yeah.
And so I've found now that I've done this for a while that when I have my biggest response, when my first reply is not only no, but hell no, then I got to circle back and say, why am I doing that? And what, you know, what's driving that such a visceral response, such a visceral negative response. And I usually end up revisiting it and then doing it and then being like, that was a great experience.
I'm glad you are comfortable talking because it's, you know, you look for advice from people that are at a certain level in life, but sometimes the best advice can come from people that are at the same level as you or someone who's uncomfortable talking, but has experienced stuff that you just wouldn't be comfortable talking about. And now we're talking in these environments and there's more conversations. There's more conversation about men, young men. And I think that's, look at this group right here. Look at what we've done in our lives. There's so much experience here that needs to be spoken about and experiences that we've had and journeys that we're on that would, there needs to be more people talking. That's the biggest thing. Me growing up in Australia, it was always keep your feelings underneath you and just deal with whatever's coming. Whereas I think it's now important. I'm middle aged and I'm talking more about my feelings and emotions than I ever have in my life. And it's been really good.
Agreed. And then people hear it, right? Like your goal is to get this out to as many people as possible. And I think this certainly transcends baseball. This relates to anybody.
Yeah.
And so just hearing, you know, us talking about it, they're like, oh yeah, that's me. I think I'll try X, or, you know, I wasn't really going to go to this thing. Maybe I'll go and I'll try it and just, you know, so if we can get one person to do that, then
yeah,
I think we call it a success.
That's exactly how we feel about it, because I came up in an era, and I'm not the old guy or whatnot, but like, you didn't really speak up outside the team. You didn't do type of stuff like this because, you know, it just wasn't the norm. It wasn't what guys did. So what I don't want to seem disrespectful asking this question by any means, but like,
I think you'd have a hard time being disrespectful to me.
How, like, okay, like we're going to go baseball player towards the end of his career. You can get to a point where you feel a little bit underappreciated, disrespected, and that type of thing. In a world now that, like you said, you guys put your lives on the line for people, for those members that didn't make it back from that airplane or the helicopter, how do you guys continue in a crazy world to just stay focused on that message and not deviate from that path, not get discouraged because you don't feel like you're getting appreciated? That's something for me that is, I'm super passionate. I would love to hear just how you guys just are just so locked in continuously.
So it's not that easy, right? And it's challenging for a lot of people. I feel fortunate that I have had the ability to transition from the military into a civilian medical career. And now I work for the VA, so I'm kind of reapplying that service mentality by helping the veterans. But that is a big problem. What is the rate for suicide among military members? It's high. You know, we lose a lot of military members to suicide after that transition. You know, my wife and I were talking about this morning, you know, leaving baseball, where this is your identity, right? This, you focus so much of your life into this one identity. And then how do you transition into something else, right? It's the same with the military. Like, you look at the Navy SEALs or the pararescue men, where they're responsible for saving people's lives, or for, you know, they're in charge of, you know, explosives and medications. And then they get out and they're like, all right, now what am I qualified to do? And so much of that is, you know, their identity is wrapped up into that it's a hard transition. And I imagine leaving professional sports is the same way. You're like, all right, what now? You know, what's my life like now?
It's like you said, this is what's, you know, this is the reason why we sit down and do this type of stuff. It's our way of feeling like, you know, we're fulfilling that need, giving back, and, you know, reaching those guys. And I think that's that change, like you said with yourself, you wouldn't maybe do this a couple of years back. And now it's like, all right, you know, I feel like I want to do this stuff now. And it's inspiring.
Yeah. And like I said, it's a responsibility. And I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, you've been blessed. You've been given this opportunity. You've had this outstanding career and you're like, okay, now what? Now, how do I even give some of that back? And people just get lost in that if they can't do that. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of military service members get caught up in that.
You were talking about doing hard things and remember those, even your shirt. I love your shirt.
Yeah, my shirt is...
Remember everyone deployed.
So every Friday you wear red, like at the VA, just to remind people that we still have people downrange, you know, in harm's way. And I thought maybe I'd just wear that.
And I love it.
Shout out to everybody that's not with their family, you know, protecting our freedom.
That's awesome.
So we can sit here and talk about stuff.
Gotta get some
So it was 2015 and I was with the Boston Red Sox. And the day before, a buddy of mine calls me. He goes, hey, show up at 4:45 in the morning tomorrow. I'm like, why would I show up at 4:45 in the morning? He goes, just show up and we'll meet you in the gym. So we go in the gym. I walk in. There's a whole group. There's coaches and field coordinators and we're all in there. Guys have bandanas on and the music's blasting. Like, and I'm like, what is going on? And they're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to run a mile. We're going to come back. We're going to do, you're going to put this vest on. We're going to run a mile. I'm like, okay. He goes, we're going to come back. We're all going to come back. We're going to do 100 pull-ups. We're going to do 200 push-ups. We're going to do 300 air squats, and then we're going to go run a mile. And I'm like, I'm not doing this. He's like, yes, you are. And he's like, we're all doing this. I look around, and everyone's like, yeah, let's go. And we go, and we do the Murph. And it was, at first, I'm like, this is brutal. It was an unbelievable experience, the camaraderie and everyone cheering each other on. Talk to us about a little bit about the background of the Murph.
I love that, right? Because I can see it in your face. Yes. You're like, oh, this sucks, but it's so great.
Exactly.
Right? The experience. Yes.
That feeling of getting done is, oh, man, that accomplishment.
Right. But it epitomizes kind of everything that we're trying to do here. It brings people together as a team, right? The camaraderie, that, you know, that team feeling. You're cheering more for the person that's coming in last than the person that's coming in first. And it's recognizing the sacrifices of others, you know. So like I said, I was on the recovery mission of Michael Murphy, and I transitioned really quickly. Like I said, I was supposed to be in my internship starting July 1st. You know, I called them on the 28th. And I'm like, I'm not going to make it, you know. And so I showed up, and then, like, I think on the 12th, I was back in the States, and I had my white coat, and I'm like, what the hell just happened to me? but a good way to kind of delve in and kind of bury yourself is a medical internship where you're just grinding it out again. But I just remember having this feeling, this sad feeling of loss, you know, like all those guys died for what, you know, and it always stuck with me. And then I started CrossFit in 2007 when I was doing my residency. And, you know, I don't know how familiar you guys are with CrossFit, but the Hero Wads, you know, back in 2007, there was like four of them. And one of them was Murph. And I was like, hey, I wonder if that's the same Murph that I recovered. And so I researched it. And sure enough, you know, and I was like, well, I'm going to do Murph on Memorial Day. Because usually Memorial Day for me, you know, just I ended up sad and drunk and feeling sorry for myself. So I'm like, this will be a good way to just kind of get out there, bust it out, suffer, do a little bit of reflection. And I did it. And I was like, that was awesome. So the next year I told the gym, I'm like, hey, we're all going to do this on Memorial Day. And right, we had that same experience that you had. I'm like, this is fantastic. I'm like, this needs to be a national pastime. This needs to be a tradition that we do in the United States, not just to remember Michael Murphy, but everybody that has paid the ultimate sacrifice, right? We put a little skin in the game, right? Put a little effort into it. And then, you know, the barbecue tastes better. And, you know, and so we started doing that. And then I actually contacted Mike Murphy's dad, Dan, because I was like, hey, I got this idea. You know, I'm sure he's, you know, everybody's calling him up and saying, hey, I got this idea. And so I remember trying to pitch him the idea because the workout, right? You said the workout, it's a mile run, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 squats, and then a mile run. And by the way, wear body armor or 20-pound vest with that. And the way that started was I would just, you know, people would sign up and then do it at their own gyms. And so Dan Murphy, I remember I can close my eyes and picture, you know, me being on the phone with him. He's like, let me see if I got this right. You're going to have people donate money to do Michael's workout in their own gym or wherever. I was like, yeah, that's basically the idea. He's like, good luck with that. And so I took off with nothing but a Facebook page and some contacts with the CrossFit community. And it just spread like wildfire. And, you know, of all the things that I've been involved with, I think that is the thing that I'm most proud of. Because now it gets people, it brings it to their attention, right? It's like Murph, like Memorial Day Murph. And I get letters, I get pictures from people doing it, you know, all over. I got a picture from a guy in Ukraine, like contractors, you know, in Ukraine on Memorial Day last year, and they did Murph in Ukraine. I'm like, don't you guys have something else to do? But kind of all over the world, right? Australia, they were doing it. Like, it's huge, and it just speaks to the, you know, the root cause of it, like the feeling behind it, right? Like when you were talking about it, your eyes were lighting up and you're like, that sucked.
Yep.
But it was awesome.
Exactly.
Right.
So true.
We had people in San Diego, staff members that we would do the Murph every year.
Yeah.
And
every year.
Next year they're like, all right, I'm doing it with the vest
or I'm beating
my time. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. It was unbelievable how they got over that hump. They did it. And now their mind takes them to, I'm going to do it better next.
What's next?
Yep.
Right. And that's what I always like to say, you know, what's your Murph, right? Because you don't have to do, like, if you can do the whole thing, I would say you don't have to be a Navy SEAL to do it, but it helps. Right. but you don't have to do the whole thing. Like, if you can't do the whole thing, just do something. Just do a little bit more than you think you can do.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, my dad, who was 90 at the time, came out to visit, and I put together a Murph for him. And he did a Murph. And my nine-year-old, my girls were nine at the time, so we had from 9 to 90 doing Murph. And it's not about doing it RX'd. It's just about putting in the effort and the sweat and the pain for other people's sacrifice.
That's so true.
Nothing better than that sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
Right.
And when it comes with a purpose as well.
Yeah.
I mean, just incredible.
Yeah.
Right. I don't try to claim that I created the workout or that I created Memorial Day. I'm like that guy that took the peanut butter and put it in the chocolate and made that Reese's peanut butter. That tasted so great. Yeah, but really, cool. I mean, it speaks more to what it brings to the crowd, and
that's
just
cool.
Honored to be a small part of it.
That's so awesome. That's awesome. My last question as we finish up is, a lot of times when you're in a movie, you want to look and, hey, who played my role?
Yeah,
who depicted me? What do you think about how you were depicted in Lone Survivor?
Yeah, the irony. I'm going to be portrayed in a movie?
I don't know if your character was doing the Murph challenge.
Like I said, Marcus is about your size. Mark Wahlberg is about my size. I'm like, why couldn't they? But anyway. Yeah, it's funny. Like I said, the irony. You're like, hey, they're going to play me in a movie. And they're like, oh, all right. Maybe don't go see that movie.
That's funny.
So actually, when they started filming, or before they started filming and they were kind of putting the cast and stuff together, Marcus called me. We still talk once in a while. And he said, hey, do you want to play you in the movie? And I was like, no. Had I known who they were going to cast, I probably would have played me. I was like thinking, no, let's get some young strapping lad in there, you know. And,
that's
anyway, cool. It wasn't, like I said, it's cool to be like featured in a movie, but that movie was all about the teammates. I told you the rescue scene was a bit Hollywood-ish, but all of the action between the Taliban and the teammates was as real to life as possible. Marcus made sure that they didn't change that at all. And so all of the wounds that you see them get in the movie are based on autopsy reports. Wow. And like, that's how detailed they went. And apparently Marcus was on scene, advisor and stuff. And he told Peter Berg, who was the director, he said, if you make my guys look bad, I'll kill you.
Mm. Oh.
And so I think he was properly motivated to make sure that.
That's awesome. So, yeah. Well, Josh, thank you so much for your time, for your stories, for your service, and for what you continue to do. Really appreciate you coming and joining us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Yeah. Great meeting you. Great to be back with my professional athlete crew. Yeah. I feel right at home. Yeah.